They didn't tell us the dam would collapse. They didn't tell us to leave.
Lao residents continue to suffer effects from flooding. It's Monday, August 13th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, water is also a problem for Rohingya refugees. Australia's population booms. An Indian-born CEO readies her exit from PepsiCo. Vintage jewelry, teaching robots to learn. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The catastrophic collapse of a dam in southern Laos has displaced thousands and left scores dead, with the toll expected to climb. The disaster is so severe it has prompted the Lao government to halt the approval of new dams until a thorough review of its existing projects is conducted. David Boyle reports from Atapu Province.
2 weeks after Laos' catastrophic dam collapse, rescue teams still somehow find survivors. More than 7,000 people were displaced when an auxiliary dam at the ZP and Zinam Noi hydropower complex collapsed, unleashing a 5 billion cubic metres surge of water. This air regiment has rescued more than 1,500 survivors, while ferrying supplies out to others cut off by the floodwaters. Increasingly, though, they are finding corpses. The official death toll is now up to 35, with nearly 100 still missing. The tales of those who survived are terrifying and deeply saddening. Samled Indavong whisked his wife and three kids to the relative safety of a boat right before an uprooted building crashed into his home.
We started to escape at midnight. I could not make it quickly enough to drop my grandparents onto the boat, and then I had to rush because the house was falling, so I lost my grandparents.
He carries this picture of his grandmother Chantai perched on his few remaining possessions. The body of his grandfather Pan has still not been recovered. Lieutenant Colonel Kamsuk Kamluangtep, who is heading up the Air Force's rescue operation, can't say how much longer it will take to find the remaining survivors or deceased.
I'm really upset about this, and I've been working from the beginning until now without stopping, and I'm very happy to be helping the people.
Out in the flood zone, some villagers are starting to return to inspect the damage. Most buildings here in Ban Mai, where the water surged up to 10 metres high, have been obliterated or heavily damaged, including the local pagoda. Those fortunate enough to still have a house are counting the cost of the damage. Nothing could have saved Samled Intavong's house, but he's angry he was not told just how serious the pending disaster was in advance.
At 4 o'clock, the village chief told us to prepare because they would release the dam. They didn't tell us the dam would collapse. They didn't tell us to leave.
The disaster has prompted the Lao government to finally reconsider its long criticized oversight of scores of foreign-built hydropower dams it has approved. That marks a significant change, but is little consolation to those whose lives have been destroyed. David Boyle for VOA News in Atapu Province, Laos.
These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll currently find on voanews.com. Concern grows over fate of Chinese professor. Tens of thousands rally to kick U.S. base off Okinawa. Survivors recount horror of Lao Dam collapse. Lombok earthquake rattles Indonesian tourism. Red Cross emergency teams tackle North Korea's heat wave. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. UN agencies, together with Bangladeshi authorities, are making a big push to quickly move thousands of Rohingya refugees at risk of landslides and floods to safer areas of Cox's Bazar. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The Cox's Bazar area has been coping with one of the heaviest monsoon seasons in years in Bangladesh, with the heaviest downpours coming at the end of July. UN refugee spokesman William Spindler says the torrential rains have tested the abilities of the many preparations and emergency measures which had been made to withstand the ravages of the expected storms. He says there was great concern that many of the fragile structures sheltering the large Rohingya refugee population would be swept away.
The refugee settlements have largely weathered the storms, proving the value of months of mitigation efforts. These activities go hand in hand with continuing intense efforts to ensure the massive refugee settlements can cope with the adverse weather. The scale is immense, as for example, Kutupalong refugee settlement shelters more than 600,000 refugees on 13 square kilometers, and it is today the largest such settlement in the world.
Most of the more than 700,000 Rohingya who have fled violence and persecution from Myanmar to Bangladesh since August are living in makeshift shelters in this squalid, overcrowded camp. Spindler says aid agencies have relocated nearly 24,000 refugees at high risk of landslides and floods. He says this is more than half of an estimated 41,000 Rohingya in greatest need of being moved to safer areas. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Happening now in Asia, North Korea is denouncing U.S. calls for enforcing international sanctions despite its goodwill moves and says progress on denuclearization promises could not be expected if Washington followed an outdated acting script. Pyongyang says Washington is insisting on denuclearization first. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. It's the start of a brand new week, and we're glad you're with us on VOA Asia. Australia's population has reached 25 million for the first time. That's according to official estimates. Over the past 3 years, Australia's population has grown by about 400,000 people a year, a rise fueled mostly by immigration. From Sydney, Phil Mercer tells us the population boom has prompted a debate about how many people Australia needs and the role of new settlers in sustaining economic growth.
Big or small, the debate about population in Australia is divisive. There is an argument that because of stagnant wages, congestion and unaffordable housing, immigration should be scaled back. The federal government, however, has said that new settlers boost the economy. Some experts also stress that the nation needs more skilled workers to support an ageing population. Population is a pertinent political issue. There have been calls for an official inquiry into population growth. An opposition Labour leader, Bill Shorten, says there's an out-of-control number of people coming to Australia on working visas. The Australian Bureau of Statistics population clock estimates Australia adds one new resident every 83 seconds, while a migrant arrives on average every 2 minutes, with the largest number coming from India and China. Sydney and Melbourne account for about two-fifths of the country's population. Ian Lowe, an emeritus professor of science, technology and society at Griffith University, believes that rapid population growth has eroded Australia's quality of life.
The more rapidly the population increases, the harder it is to provide the services that people expect. And I think the problem that the governments are facing is that people in particularly Sydney and Melbourne, but to a lesser extent also Brisbane and Perth, quite accurately perceive that their quality of life is going backwards because the infrastructure hasn't been expanded at the same rate as the population. So the roads are more crowded, the public transport is less adequate, it's harder to get the recreational services that people want.
At the start of the 20th century, there were just over 3.5 million Australians. There was high population growth after the Second World War, and by June 2000, there were 19 million people in Australia. The nation has reached the 25 million person milestone almost a quarter of a century earlier than predicted in a prominent government report published in 2002.
All of those extra Australians will have to have a way to get around without damaging the environment. Australian scientists have test-driven two cars powered by a carbon-free fuel derived from ammonia. A team from the Australian government's research agency, the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization, says the pioneering technology will allow highly flammable hydrogen to be safely transported in the form of ammonia and used as a widely available fuel. Phil Mercer drives back into our program with more.
Researchers have found a way to use a thin membrane to turn Australian-made hydrogen into ammonia. This could be shipped safely to markets in Asia, as well as parts of Europe. At its destination, the liquid ammonia would then be converted back into hydrogen and used to power cars and buses, as well as for electricity generation and industrial processes. Dr. David Harris is the research director at Australia's government science agency, the CSIRO.
The special thing about the technology that we have is that it allows you to produce very pure hydrogen directly with a membrane system from ammonia.
The technology has the support of Japanese car maker Toyota and South Korea's Hyundai Motor Company. Scientists say hydrogen, a highly flammable gas that can be volatile and hard to transport safely, creates a low-emission fuel for cars. The Australian team describes the membrane technology that separates hydrogen from other gases as a watershed moment for energy. Claire Johnson, the chief executive of Hydrogen Mobility Australia, an industry association, says the pioneering research could forever change the transport sector.
We see that as a really exciting opportunity to decarbonise the transport sector, but also position Australia as one of the lead suppliers of hydrogen around the world. There is some competition to play that role, however. Norway, Brunei and Saudi Arabia have all flagged that they wish to be an exporter of hydrogen around the world.
There are only a handful of hydrogen-powered cars in Australia, but there are tens of thousands across Japan, South Korea and Singapore. The South Korean government has recently announced plans for 16,000 more hydrogen-fueled cars and 310 special refilling stations. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, a change of management at a huge soft drink company. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news from VOA Asia, more than 156,000 people remain displaced after a magnitude 6.9 earthquake struck the Indonesian island of Lombok late Sunday, where the local economy is heavily dependent on tourism. It was one of three major quakes to rock the island in less than 2 weeks, producing more than 350 aftershocks. Visit VOA Asia Facebook for more. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, 62-year-old Indra Nooyi has recently announced she's stepping down in October as chief executive of giant soft drink multinational PepsiCo after 12 years at the helm. She will remain chairwoman until early next year. The announcement ends a storied career with PepsiCo that extends nearly 25 years for the Indian-born woman, a rare sight among leaders of Fortune 500 corporations. The company's revenues nearly doubled under her leadership as she moved it toward a more nutritious portfolio of drinks and snacks. IHS Global Insight chief economist Rajiv Biswas has followed Nooyi's career. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty she is an iconic figure in India, coming from a middle-class family in the southern city of Chennai, educated and entering the corporate world there before attaining a scholarship to attend the Yale School of Management in 1978. She joined PepsiCo in 1994 and attained her current post in 2006.
At a time when there's a lot of concerns in many countries about trying to develop women in leadership positions in all different sorts of areas, in government, in business, and other areas, she really has set a very high standard in terms of what needs to be done and what can be done And I think also in terms of diversity, she's also iconic that, you know, an Indian who moved over to the U.S. and started pretty much at the bottom, worked all the way up to becoming the CEO and chairperson of PepsiCo. I think one of the great achievements that she's brought into industry in the U.S. and also globally is to really encourage more female talent to develop. But I think her approach was very much based on developing a pipeline of succession and not just having it by regulatory mandate, which is the government approach that some governments are now taking. But her approach is saying, well, we really got to look at your whole talent pipeline. How do you develop the talent over time? And I think that's really a very important value added that she's bringing to that whole debate. Obviously, as a business leader, she transformed PepsiCo. She moved it much more towards a healthy mix of products. And so I think also from that point of view, her success as a business leader is also very important to recognize.
Well, this also must be a very proud moment for India, given her accomplishments.
There's quite a few Indian business leaders who have become prominent in the U.S. You know, there has been considerable examples of success, but she's at the very top of the list amongst highly respected business leaders, and an example for young, you know, talented Indians who think, well, I can start, you know, pretty much at the bottom of a, you know, multinational or other kind of corporate and work my way to the top. Now, of course, Indian business is also becoming much more globalized. There's a lot of Indian multinationals that are very large global players. So I think it's also important in the Indian context to encourage talented Indian women to be ambitious for the top roles within Indian multinationals as well. And there are Indian women leaders who are very, very successful. It's interesting to see her success in the U.S. I think it's also a very big positive for the U.S. that it's such an open multicultural society that someone can come from India, especially a woman, and work all the way up to the very top of one of the biggest U.S. multinationals. It's a fabulous example of, I think, the diversity and multiculturalism of the U.S., which actually elsewhere in the world is probably not really there in that many other countries.
Indra Nooyi told Bloomberg News she plans to advocate for more women to serve at the highest levels of corporations. Women today lead 24 out of the 500 companies listed on Wall Street's S&P 500 index. According to business channel CNBC, four of the top five U.S. defense companies will soon be led by women, including Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, and Boeing Defense, Space, and Security. This news from VOA Asia. The International Federation of Red Cross says the current heat wave in North Korea poses a serious threat to vulnerable population groups and to the country's food supply. Red Cross emergency response teams armed with water pumps are helping to irrigate fields hard hit by North Korea's heat wave. You'll find no shortage of information resources at VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, Hugo Cole has been interested in art and design since he was a child. In college, he studied finance, but also took several jewelry-making classes to satisfy his curiosity about this form of art and the history behind it. 25 years ago, Cole turned his passion into a career, and over the years, as VOA's Faiza El-Masri tells us, he developed his own style of vintage jewelry using the same techniques as Industrial Revolution artisans at the end of the 18th century, Faith Lapidus narrates.
Hugo Cole's Museum of American Jewelry Design and Manufacturing in Harrisonburg, Virginia, is the culmination of his dream, preserving history while doing business. In the museum, he keeps all the old machines he's managed to find and salvage.
Just sharing knowledge and information. Just based on that idea alone, I think people find this interesting and they're curious about it.
And he was curious enough to learn how to maintain them and keep them functioning in his workshop. Not only did he restore these machines, he revived a centuries-old technique for jewelry making.
The things I'm talking about are being die struck and die rolled, which means a lot of pressure between two pieces of steel. And so when we die strike something or die roll something, typically it's going to go at least a couple of generations. A lot of times people will be in love with vintage jewelry for a number of reasons. One of them is the design. The process of die striking allows for tremendous detail.
Cole creates these details using 3D molds. He acquired this collection more than 25 years ago in Providence, Rhode Island, which was the jewelry-making capital of the world at the start of the Industrial Revolution. The collection dates back to the late 1800s and early 1900s.
These pieces are the ancestors of American metalsmithing, silversmithing, and they bring in a very tangible way, the processes, yes, the technical skills that are involved, yes, the meaning of what these pieces meant to people.
Before the Industrial Revolution, only the rich could commission artisans to make jewelry for them. But mechanical mass production made jewelry affordable for everyone.
The wealthy people still had jewelry that was made in gold. This new middle class had things that were made in silver and clad metal. And poor people had the exact same artwork in brass and in copper.
I really enjoy the entire scope of what's happening here. It's not just the preservation of the work, but it's the recreation of the works, and it's the selling of the works to the public so they all become part of our culture again.
So I wanted to see about getting, some stacks.
And for customers like Sarah Brown, it's nice to own a part of America's heritage.
When I come in, I love to be able to look and see that you can that the jewelry is made right here. Hugo is often here. It feels very personal, and the pieces, like I say, they're unique and beautiful. They have a timelessness about them that just feels really good, and it feels like they kind of tell a story.
And Hugo Cole enjoys bringing those stories to life. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Today's robots can be programmed to do many things, from vacuuming floors to assembling cars. But teaching them to recognize and correct a mistake, well, that's much harder to do. A group of scientists led by researchers at Carnegie Mellon University is trying to solve that problem. VOA's George Pudich shares their strategy.
Robots welding chassis at this car factory are faster and more accurate than humans, and they never need a brake. But if these robots make a mistake, they cannot go back and correct it.
This is a hard problem because it requires a level of contextual information that we typically don't see in robot systems.
Henny Admoni and her students are trying to teach this robot, named Baxter, to act as a grocery clerk packing items into a bag. A combination of standard and infrared cameras helps Baxter recognize the objects.
For us, the really interesting part is not necessarily the perception of the robot, but how does it incorporate that information into its reasoning system, and what does the underlying reasoning system look like?
But why don't programmers incorporate all possible errors and potential fixes into the algorithm that drives the robot?
That's not particularly efficient because they might miss an error in this scenario, and when they move to a new situation, when the robot's manipulating some other object, now they need to redefine all those errors again.
So right now, researchers are trying to figure out how the robot takes in and interprets information in a way that lets it do the kind of reasoning they want it to do.
It's pretty difficult. It sounds really abstract. We do it as humans very, very naturally, but we need to build these mathematical models so that robots can be able to do it too.
The four-year project is being done in collaboration with Brigham Young University, Tufts University, and the University of Massachusetts. As for robots that can fix their own errors and recover from mistakes, Admoni says that technology may still be 10 to 15 years away. George Pudich, VOA News, Pittsburgh.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us online at iTunes and SoundCloud, and of course on VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com. You'll also find us on the radio, like CCU Radio at National Chungcheng University in Taipei, Taiwan. We thank everyone there who's tuned in today. Among these great radio stations, we have great people who help us put on this program, like director Tracy Carter, engineer Zeynep Abdel-Rahman, our managing editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard as part of our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We wave to you and wish you a great day.